Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. What would you do if a friend called and said, "Hey, I have some good information on a stock I know about. Don't ask me for details, but if you buy some of this stock today, it's a guaranteed score, minimum 10 times your investment." See, okay, the fact that you'd even think about it proves that the basic motivation of greed that underpins free enterprise has not been snuffed out altogether. But question two, if your stock's doing well, do you mind if the chief executive officer of that company, a man already making $500 million a year, is about to exercise a pile of stock options and is negotiating a severance package, including free travel and cars and drivers and guards? Oh, so this you have a problem with. Connection listeners, the focus is on the CEO, the fat pay packages, the golden severance deals. But what is the real issue here? Is your concern over executives' personal business pure moral outrage? Or is the health of the entire economy compromised by excess compensation? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With me today is John Cassidy. He's a writer for The New Yorker. He's also author of an article that's in this week's edition. It's called The Greed Cycle. But before we talk with John, we're going to talk with Laurie Cohen. Laurie's a senior writer for The Wall Street Journal, covering such stories as WorldCom, AOL, and most recently, Tyco. Hi, Laurie.
Hi.
I have to ask you first, though, about a letter that's in today's Wall Street Journal from the former Chairman, CEO of GE, Jack Welch. Seems that the letter's making news.
Well, what Mr. Welch disclosed today is that he is going to, he's asked the board to abrogate the terms of his severance agreement, and he says he's going to give up the $86,000 a year in compensation he gets, and he's also going to give up another really significant perk, which is use of the corporate plane for free and also a corporate apartment, which he values at $2 to $2.5 million a year, and says he's going to instead pay the company for the use of those things.
Why the change of heart?
Well, Jack Welch is involved, as everybody probably knows at this point, in a really messy divorce case, and his wife, who doesn't like the terms of the settlement he offered, disclosed that he was taking a whole bunch of perks, including these things, and some sports tickets and food and restaurant expenses that he's denying. But the change of heart is that, you know, given the publicity about Tyco and Adelphia and WorldCom and executive pay in general, he's now decided that this probably doesn't look so good or smell so clean. And so, you know, he said that he's the world has changed, and so he's now asked the board to reconsider. But also there's an informal SEC inquiry into Welch's employment contract as well.
All right. We'll talk a little bit more about this later in the program. But, Laurie, we wanted to get the latest on what's happening with Tyco International. That's the business headline of the hour.
Well, I think what Welch did pales in comparison. I don't think he did anything
illegal, right?
Because much of it was disclosed. But what Dennis Kozlowski, who is the former CEO, recently deposed CEO of Tyco, did is it would appear to be far worse if the Manhattan prosecutor's allegations are true. They're alleging that he and other executives took more than $600 million of undisclosed pay and benefits from Tyco over the course of the last 3 or 4 years, in addition to hefty pay contracts that were disclosed, by the way.
And there appears that there's even more to come on this news that we're expecting today, that corporate loans were given to people even lower down in the company that may also have been forgiven, as they were to Mr. Kozlowski.
Right. The Wall Street Journal reported all that back in early August, but there were 44 people who were relocated quietly, I might add, from Exeter, New Hampshire to Boca Raton, Florida, where Tyco established its unofficial headquarters. In other words, it set up shop there and didn't really tell many people. But those folks were all given housing loans that Kozlowski later forgave, and he also forgave his own $19 million loan and paid himself an additional $12 million for the taxes that would have been owed on that if it were income.
What's your sense of how this is going to be tracked, Laurie? Because over the past few months, there's been so much talk about how the WorldComs and the Enrons and the other corporations like this have undermined confidence in the American market. Is Tyco just going to keep that lack of confidence simmering?
Oh, no. Tyco's now has a new CEO whose pay package is significantly less, although it's still, you know, a decent
I guess
pay
I meant
package.
The story of Tyco and Kozlowski and Schwartz and, you know, whether or not that's just going to remain in the headlines.
I think Tyco will remain in the headlines as more and more stuff comes out, if it does. I think most of it that is going to come out is probably out already with the indictment the other day, but I think this is not the end of it. I think that, you know, the Wall Street Journal reported on Friday that Gerald Levin, who is the CEO of AOL Time Warner, who recently retired, is going to be making $1 million a year as an advisor to that company until 2005. And as everyone knows at this point, that merger hasn't exactly gone very well, and AOL's Time Warner stock is hitting new lows on a daily basis. So I think these things will be in the headlines for some time to come.
Let's bring John Cassidy into the conversation. John, as I mentioned earlier, is a writer for The New Yorker. He was also business editor of the Sunday Times of London, and his book .com, The Greatest Story Ever Sold, is considered one of the good records of the 1990s. Hi, John.
Good morning. Thanks for inviting me on.
John, I want to just quote you a little bit of Mr. Welch's letter in the Wall Street Journal. He says, "In reality, my 1996 employment contract could be misportrayed as an excessive retirement package rather than what it is, part of a fair employment and post-employment contract made 6 years ago." Skip down a few lines and he goes on, "There was not a single day in the past 6 years that I thought it was improper, and I don't believe it's improper today. I was given extra compensation for remaining at GE until I was 1965. Later, when he turns in the letter, he says, "One thing I learned during my years as CEO is that perception matters." When we see someone like Jack Welch taking the severance package that he had and in effect saying, "All right, fine, I don't want it. You take it away. If it's going to cause problems for my old business buddies, I don't want to have anything to do with it." Are we looking at a serious change in what you describe as the greed cycle?
Yes, I think we are. I mean, 1996, if we, you know, you think back to then, that was sort of the start of the big boom on Wall Street. And Jack Welch was flying high then. The contract he got then probably didn't seem too outrageous. You know, as he says in his letter today, the whole context of business has changed. Back then, Jack Welch and other business leaders were on front of the magazines as the sort of heroes of the hour. And, you know, I don't think, as somebody mentioned in the introduction, that many GE shareholders would really have complained about this sort of package back then, because GE stock was going up every year. It was one of the best performing stocks in the 90s. In the last year or two, of course, GE's fallen a long way. People get angry and they look for scapegoats, and suddenly, you know, Jack Welch is dragged into the scandal pit. It's a remarkable turnaround, really.
Your article, The Greed Cycle, in effect, starts in 1814 with the start of the public corporation, Francis Cabot Lowell, the Boston merchant. And you describe what was then considered to be, and I think many people would think it ought to hold true today, the implied bargain of the publicly held corporation. Can you describe that bargain?
Right. Well, what I'm trying to do in the piece is sort of explain the background to all these scandals. I think people get a bit confused when they see, you know, Enron, Tyco, etc. What does it all mean? I try to bring it back down to basics and explain how public companies work, because I don't think many people realize that the public company is essentially a bargain, as you said, between the shareholders who own the company and the managers, people like Jack Welch, who run the company. Now, the shareholders, you know, as they exercise ownership rights, the company is supposed to be running their interest, but there's no real way for them to monitor the managers. And at the time, back in the 18th century, early 19th century, most people didn't think public companies would last very long, because they thought the managers would just steal the money from the shareholders. Adam Smith and some other early economists thought that private companies would remain the traditional way, or the usual way of doing business, because public companies, they'd be inevitably riven by scandal and by theft and by self-dealing on the part of the managers. And what we've seen over the last couple of centuries, really, is a sort of waning and waxing of this greed cycle, where the managers, you know, start, when things are going well, the shareholders don't monitor them very closely, and they start to take as much of the company's money as they can for themselves. As I say, while the stock price is going up, most shareholders don't really care because they're making money as well. But when the stock market falls, everything changes and people start to look more closely at the actions of the managers and whether the enormous salaries and enormous benefits they get are deserved. And that's the stage of the cycle we're in now.
But one of the substantial turning points in that cycle that brought us to where we are right now was the introduction and the delight that corporate executives found with the idea of stock options.
Yeah, well, stock options are at the center of all this. And I tried to explain where they came from and, you know, a stock option is really an attempt to deal with this problem at the heart of the public company. You have to look at it from a sort of economic basis and think, how do you get the managers to do what the shareholders want? That was the problem back in the 50s and 60s. Companies like GE and IBM, etc., were seen, it seemed that the managers of those companies were just running the companies in their own interests. They were building factories that weren't needed, flying around on executive jets, etc. The shareholders didn't seem to matter that much. At least that's what people thought on Wall Street. So a stock option was a device which was invented to try and make the managers take notice of what the shareholders needed, because essentially a stock option turns a manager into a stockholder. If the stock does well, the managers do well. So there was a certain logic to it in the beginning, and they became more and more popular as the stock market went up, because stock options, their value is linked to the value of the underlying stock. So as the stock market went up in the 1980s and 1990s, stock options spread to the extent that they basically became a standard form of remuneration for most CEOs. Back in 1980, only about a third of CEOs had stock options. But by 2000, virtually all of them did, and enormous mega options worth tens of millions of dollars. So it really, what I try to trace in this piece is how the stock option changed the whole culture of corporations. Managers stopped thinking of themselves as old-fashioned business managers and started to think of themselves really as, as stockholders. And their whole design and their whole strategy was based around getting the stock up in the short term.
Laurie Cohen, just from your perspective at the Wall Street Journal, tell me whether or not the stock options that John's describing and that we'll continue talking about after our break are a key part of the business stories you're covering now.
Yes, the stock options, I think that John explained it pretty well, but they often way exceed salary and bonus, and so it's one of the great surprises, I think, in the last few months, how much many of these folks were getting in stock options and how nobody really focused on how excessive these stock options were, and as the stock declined, the options grew.
And as the market weakened, then the desperate moves that the executives made to keep the stock price high also helped drive decisions that they made, right?
Yes, and so much of their pay, most of their pay in many cases was linked to these stock options. One could argue there was a greater incentive to perhaps cook the books in some of these companies.
Laurie, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Laurie Cohen, senior writer for The Wall Street Journal, has been writing on WorldCom and AOL, is currently concentrating on what's going on with Tyco as the handcuffs jingled away across the radio and television news. Connection listeners, our number is 1-800-423-8255. There's certainly no shortage of news about the excesses of the corner office. Give us a call. Let us know what you think the issue here is. Is it one simply of your own moral outrage that it was allowed to continue, or do the decisions to pay the executives what they were paid have larger implications for the current state of the economy? My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University,
you're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. This hour we're talking about the CEO. My guest is John Cassidy. He's a writer for The New Yorker and author of this week's article, The Greed Cycle. And our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join our conversation. John, before the break we were talking about the growth in stock options. In part, this desire to maximize the value of the stocks, what dragged us through all the leverage buyouts and the corporate T. Boone Pickens rating of the 1980s. But bring us into the 1990s and what made it such a key part of the shape of the economy that we understand today.
Well, as you said, it goes back to the 1980s, really. During the 1980s, corporate raiders like T. Boone Pickens and Carl Icahn, using a lot of money which Michael Milken had raised for them, actually, started to attack companies like Goodyear and General Motors and Texaco, the big old line companies. They attacked the directors of those companies, saying that they weren't doing a good job for the shareholders, that the stock price was too low, and that if they were allowed to take over these companies, they'd raise the, you know, the value of the stock. And in a lot of cases, these companies were forced to sell off divisions, to fire a lot of workers, to fend off the raiders. So at that stage, the sort of shareholder value movement, which is what T. Boone Pickens and Carl Icahn and people claim to represent, was an insurgency. It was a bunch of outsiders attacking the corporate establishment. But what happened in the 1990s, as I try to explain in the piece, is that the managers of the blue-chip companies, of the IBMs, of the GEs, etc., they became raiders in a sense themselves. They adopted the values of the corporate raiders and started to focus on shareholder value and, you know, put the shareholder above employees and above customers as the main person in the company. Because if you take that perspective, if you take a shareholder value perspective to the corporation, the only people who really matter in the company are the stockholders. The employees and the customers are just there to raise money and raise value for the stockholders. Now, why did the chief executives change their opinion and, you know, adopt the stockholder value movement as their own? The only reason I could come to is because they'd been given so many stock options. You know, if you own 5 million stock options, then shareholder value seems to be a pretty sensible way to look at the company, because if it goes well, you can make hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, CEO pay has always been, not always, but for the last 20 or 30 years has been an issue. But in the 1990s, stock options enabled CEOs to make the sort of fortunes which traditionally had been reserved for people like Rockefeller and Bill Gates and J.P. Morgan. I mean, I mentioned a couple of the examples in my piece. You know, the head of the Walt Disney Company, Michael Eisner, made $600 million in 1998. That's an astonishing amount. And how did he make that money? He made it from stock options.
And was now, the ground laid for that by the business executives themselves, or was it made easier for them also by what was happening in Washington?
Well, it was made easier for them by Washington, sure. I mean, as I try to explain the piece, wittingly and unwittingly, Washington helped the CEOs. The Clinton administration, when it came in, I'm sure you remember back to 1992, Al Gore and Bill Clinton made CEO pay a big issue in the campaign and attacked the CEOs. When they got into office, they introduced a new law that limited the amount of money that corporations could deduct from their earnings for a CEO pay to $1 million. If they gave more than $1 million, they didn't get a deduction for it. So what corporations did, they said, well, you know, it's going to cost us more to pay a guy $5 million. Why don't we pay him $1 million and give him $4 million worth of stock options? Because stock options the value of stock options didn't have to be deducted from earnings, so it didn't hit corporate profits to issue stock options. So this reform, which the Clinton administration introduced as an attempt to limit the growth of executive pay, ended up being totally counterproductive and helped the, you know, enormous growth of stock options through the 1990s, which eventually, you know, as I try to explain the piece, led to a lot of the scandals. And
that's where I want to go next. The fundamental flaw in the stock option. I mean, because I read the arguments of the economists and the thinkers behind it that
right.
You know, if you can increase the value of the corporation, you're doing the work for the investors, and
right.
And if it's going up, then the customers ought to be happy and the employees ought to be happy at the same time. Certainly, that argument would have been made for Enron employees in the summer of 2000 that they were benefiting,
sure.
But from the stock option. But what's wrong with it?
Well, there's a couple of things wrong with it. The problem with the stock option as a motivating device, really, is that the value of the stock options is not determined by what the individual does. It's determined by investors in the stock market. Now, it's a bit of a subtle point, but if you think about it, how should you pay somebody for doing a task? They should really be rewarded for doing the task well. So if you're trying to pay Ken Lay, for example, you know, running Enron, you want to pay him for the things which are under his control, increasing Enron's profits, getting more customers, moving into new business areas, etc. And that's what traditional profit-related pay and bonuses do. But if you give somebody a stock option, what you're rewarding them for is getting their stock price up, i.e. you're rewarding them for the actions of others, investors, people on Wall Street, in buying the stock. And that gives the owner of the stock option, Ken Lay and people like that, an enormous incentive to deceive investors on Wall Street and to deceive the public generally who buy stocks into thinking that their company is in better shape than it is. And that's what we've seen in case after case in recent years. Managers who've owned enormous chunks of stock options, instead of telling the investors honestly that the earnings are not as good as they thought and that they can't meet the enormous expectations that Wall Street had for a lot of these companies, the managers instead said, well, if we do that, the value of the stock price is going to fall, our stock options are going to be underwater, you know, we won't be mega rich anymore. So instead, let's try and fiddle the books and make it look as if the company's doing well for a while, during which we can perhaps sell some of our stock options. So the stock options, you know, had a sort of perverse effect. As you say, on paper, they seemed like a good idea. But in practice, they ended up giving senior executives a big incentive to be crooked, basically. And that's what we've seen in recent years.
So when we talk about the excessive compensation given to the chief executive officer, we have to include in that the consideration of stock options, despite the fact that we'll see in the business pages that so-and-so is being paid $300 million, $500 million just to be the boss as well.
Yeah, I mean, the headlines are usually misleading. If you look at those, Michael Eisner, for example, I think he earned $567 million. I think, $550 million of that was from the value of exercising stock options. When the stock market's going up, CEOs don't want to be paid in cash. You know, cash is for chumps. What you want is some stock which is going to go up and make you, extremely rich rather than just quite rich. So stock option, it got to the extent where some CEOs said, well, don't pay me any salary at all, or just give me, $100,000, $200,000 a year, and I'll get all the rest of my money in stock options. Now, that's a great thing to do while the stock market's going up because, the chances are your stock is going to go up. That's right. Another problem with stock options. They reward people for an increase in the stock market generally rather than for your particular company. Because between 1996 and 97 and 2000, virtually every stock in the country was going up. So it didn't really matter how you performed. As long as you could get into that corner office at an American corporation, you were virtually guaranteed to come out a zillionaire in 3 or 4 years, as long as the stock market kept going up.
All right, Connection listeners, we're talking about performance. Pay for performance. It's noted that 20 years ago, the average chief executive officer made about 42 times that of the average production worker. Now, today, the average CEO makes 500 times that of the average production worker. You don't have to be smart in math to figure out that that chief executive officer is making more in a day than the average employee is in the year. 1-800-423-8255. To Louisville, Kentucky now. David's on the line. Hi, David.
Hi. How's everything there?
Fine. Thanks for calling.
Great show. I guess my comment would be that while I agree that executive pay has gotten out of hand, I think your guest has made a number of very good points. The question also comes down to who's really at fault here and who's going to remedy the situation. I mean, it's certainly, I don't believe, a legislative issue or somebody deciding, well, $500,000 is okay, but $750,000 is too much or millions. I mean, you've got to also then ask the question, what's going to happen if you want to change things? And who's really dropped the ball here? And I think the boards have dropped the ball. I think it gets back to some of the same problems we've had with the Enrons and with the others, where the boards are not truly independent boards and are not looking at their fiduciary responsibility properly.
David, are you in business yourself?
Yes, I am. I have a very small company that I run, but it's...
You don't have a board of directors looking over your shoulder, or you do?
No, I do not.
Yeah, okay.
I do not. But I think that's what's happened, and I think a lot of things you could look at from that point of view. But, for example, and you look at compensation in general. I mean, should ball players be making, $4 million a year, $5 million a year on average. I mean, should movie stars make $20 million for a picture? Does that make sense? I mean, there may not be public companies, but we're all ticket buyers, and in that sense, we're the ones they're beholden to, and now it costs $150 to go to a game.
David, let me just pick up the question that you have about the responsibility of the boards, of directors, and ask John in on that. John, you write near the tail end of your article that boards of directors often end up as patsies for the senior managers they're supposed to be monitoring, that the typical American board is described by Grave Crystal as 10 friends of the chairman, a token woman, or a token representative of a minority group. Is that overly cynical, or is that really what it looks like?
No, that's certainly how it looked like until very recently. I mean, the board are supposed to represent the stockholders. That's what they're there for, to represent the stockholders and to monitor the management's actions and make sure that, you know, they're not being crooked and not cheating the stockholders or the employees. But in most cases, the board members are appointed by the CEO or are appointed by the senior executives. So, you know, the idea that they were independent and that they were monitoring the CEOs was just nonsensical, really, during the 1990s, because in a lot of cases, the board member, I didn't really go into this in my piece because it really wasn't wholly about boards, other people right. have written about this, but in a lot of cases, the board members were being incentivized in very similar ways to the rest of, you know, to the CEOs. They were getting free stock options. So they had exactly the same incentives as the CEOs. I mean, their stock options, if you look at the Enron board, for example, they you know, a lot of those guys got a lot of stock options. So they had just as much an incentive to get the stock price up in the short term as the CEO did.
Incentive or hush money. You could look at it one of two ways.
No, sure, no. I mean, it certainly, in some cases, it was hush money. Now, the New York Stock Exchange has introduced a series of reforms in the last couple of months to try and make boards more independent. But it remains to be seen how independent they really will be. I interviewed Paul Volcker, the former chairman of the Federal Reserve Board, who is one of the most eminent financiers in the country. And he said, after studying this thing, sitting on a lot of boards himself, that he doesn't think, however supposedly independent the boards are, that they're never going to be really independent, because they always have a collegial feeling. They, you know, they're friendly with the CEO, and you can't really rely on the boards to monitor and stop sort of, you know, wrongdoing in the boardroom. But that, if you think about that, that's quite a frightening thought, because if the board won't monitor the CEO, who will? The auditors? Well, the auditors haven't done a good job in recent years either. You know, there's moves now to beef up accounting law, etc. So, but they've proved wanting in this task. So you say the boards are insiders, the auditors are incompetent. Who is there left? Really, I think you have to look at the government, and, you know, I sort of disagree with the caller to some extent. I think, sure, it's not for the government to determine how much corporations pay their chief executives, but I think it is for government, as the representatives of the public, to, you know, regulate these corporations and to punish wrongdoing. We're seeing that finally now, but, you know, I think a lot of responsibility does lay with the SEC and with Congress.
All right. David, thanks a lot for your call. We're going to Savannah, Georgia now, and Charles is joining us. Charles.
Thank you.
Hi.
Hello. Am I on the phone?
Yes, you are.
Thanks very much for taking my call. You know, this is something that I've thought about for a long time. It's also something that I preached a long time to a lot of people that I know. I pulled out of the market just prior to 2000, because the more I looked at information, the more nervous and scared I got about what I was seeing the corporate executives, CEOs, CFOs, everybody else, what I saw them doing to corporations by issuing stock options that were inflating the value of companies and deflating the real value of the assets. I saw them using stock options like a de facto currency to use to pay rent, buy cars, all kinds of things. The more I saw them paying themselves exorbitant, what I thought at that time, salaries, fees, options, and so forth, I thought to myself, how much does this company have to make in order to be able to compensate these people and turn a profit? And when you started looking at what they would have to sell in order to pay these people and still have anything left over for the stockholders, you got scared, and that's what I got, scared, and I pulled out.
But, Charles, in the 1990s, there was a giddiness about the
yes,
stock market
was.
that just had everybody thinking, you know, I'm making more money. It, you know, there might be something wrong with it, but making more money is not a bad thing.
Yes, that's true. That's true. And I, you know, when you look at television shows like CNBC, and they get on there and they cheerlead stocks up, right, and they report stock analysts who now we find out are in bed with these guys, and all the funny business with the books, you realize that what we have here is a giant scam that took advantage of everybody.
So what's the solution, Charles, to have the government regulate?
You know, I'd like to know where the IRS is. I'd like to know where the racketeering laws are. Because I think that there are plenty of laws on the books to take care of not only these guys, but these corporations.
And, John, I did read that the IRS is, in fact, swinging its sights from the small-time people to the potentially large, big-time tax cheats. But is that a realistic shift?
Well, I think it's sure an important shift. I mean, that's where most of the tax avoidance goes. I mean,
but that's where most of the expertise is to keep it hidden, though.
That's true. But that's exactly why you need the IRS looking more closely. I mean, it's been a bit of an unequal war in the 90s because you've had all these clever accountants working in the private sector to try and come up with these tax avoidance schemes, and the IRS has been sort of starved of funds, starved of investigators. And in a lot of cases, was directed to look at poor and middle income people. So I think it's a healthy development. They're starting to look at the rich and the powerful. I mean, as I say, that's where most of the money is. I mean, it's a bit like Willie Sutton. You know, if you're looking for the money, go for the banks. So if you're looking for tax avoidance, go for the rich people.
But they're doing it with some pretty reduced resources these days, are they?
No, that's the problem. I mean, that's the problem. But again, it's, you know, during a bull market and when everybody's making a lot of money, there's not much political backing for the IRS. And who wants to pay taxes on their stock market gains? So during the 90s, you know, the IRS was extremely unpopular. If you remember all those congressional hearings about how they were terrorizing innocent taxpayers, and the Clinton administration had to back off and actually introduce a lot of reforms of the IRS. Now the IRS has been criticized for not being aggressive enough in tracking down corporate and private malfeasance. So again, it's another example of how attitudes change depending on, you know, how the stock market's doing, how the economy in general's doing. It's really another aspect of the greed cycle, which, you know, I write about. Most people's attitudes depend on how they're doing financially, to be blunt about it.
Indeed. Okay, Charles, thanks for your call. How attitudes change. Connection listeners, here we are, 2002, and look what we're reading in the business pages. What a shock from where we were 3 years ago. 1-800-423-8255. Are we heading in the direction of a sort of rational sense of how business ought to operate, or are we just happen to be on a low point now in the greed cycle? 1-800-423-TALK. My name's Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number's 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. And this hour we're talking about the remarkable amount of money that you can make if you're a chief executive officer in this country today. In fact, it attracted so much attention that the current president, George Bush, came up with a corporate responsibility bill, which didn't address the sort of severance packages that have been much in the news, and really only said that money can be recovered if it was gathered based on some sort of false information, perhaps as in the case of a company like Enron, depending on what was known on the inside. Also an attempt to try and make corporate loans illegal. We'll be hearing more about corporate loans this week. But John Cassidy, who's a senior writer with the New Yorker and author of this week's article called The Greed Cycle, I want to just ask you about how that contrasts to the 1930s. In your article, you talk about FDR. And he was being a lot harder on the business leaders than it seems the current president is.
Well, that's true. The historical context was different. I mean, FDR came to power during the Great Recession when unemployment was, you know, up towards 30% and GDP had fallen by a third in 3 years. You know, the Okies were on their way to California at that stage. Capitalism as a system was under threat then. And FDR, although often seen as a radical, really sort of preserved capitalism by introducing the strict reforms and by lambasting the practices of the 1920s, introducing the Securities and Exchange Commission, introducing the securities laws as we know them now to try and prevent insider dealing and corporate finagling. Most of the things that happened at Enron and at Tyco and places like that happened in a slightly different but basically similar form in the late 1920s. And after the stock market crashed in 1929, it was very similar to what happened after the Nasdaq crash in 2000. There was a gradual uncovering of all the previous malfeasance and crookery and rising public outrage over what had happened. Several businessmen committed suicide when their nefarious activities came to light, just as one of the senior executives at Enron has committed suicide. And FDR reacted to this by introducing a whole new raft of legislation as part of the New Deal packages, which, as I say, I think played an important part in preserving capitalism and certainly in restoring the public's faith in capitalism.
But if I don't now, skew the history too far by stripping away those different comparisons of what it was like in the 30s and what it's like in the year 2002, it seems to me that fundamentally what we're talking about in FDR's time was an attempt to try and legislate morality at the corporation. But what's happening in 2002 from Washington is a sense that you don't want to try and impose any kind of legal moral standards on the corporations.
That's certainly true. I mean, I'm not trying to say that the Bush administration, you know, is in any way comparable to FDR.
Right.
Obviously, they come at things from a completely different ideological perspective. I mean, you know, this is basically a very conservative administration made up of a lot of CEOs who the last thing they would have wanted until very recently is any attempt by government to interfere with business. I mean, what we've seen in the last year or two is the Bush administration basically dragged screaming and objecting into doing something. I mean, you know, it was only after the recent raft of scandals that they started to do anything at all, really, and they jumped on the congressional bandwagon. I think the key event was the revelations of the WorldCom scandal, which happened earlier in the summer. And, you know, the sums involved there, $7 billion, it appears, were so large. And WorldCom was such a sort of mainstream company, I mean, owns MCI, which is the second biggest long-distance company in the country. It was hard to say that this was just a few bad apples, which is what people had been saying, to use the usual cliche. You know, it seemed that this was like a mainstream corporate practice to deceive the stockholders. And at that stage, the Bush administration, I think somebody must have said to the president, look, this is, you know, potentially a political disaster. We're associated with big business to an extent of no previous American government, really, even more than the Eisenhower administration. The Bush administration is associated with large corporations. And, you know, they've been involved in a damage limitation exercise. The president's made a few tough-sounding speeches, but you're right, the actual content of the legislation they've introduced is not that radical. Their argument is basically that, you know, you should leave it to the courts and the courts should throw the buck at the crooks, but they haven't really been, they haven't made any attempt to introduce sort of FDR-type legislation. That's true.
Let's go to our calls. We've got Al waiting on the line in Louisville, Kentucky. Hi, Al.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Al.
I'm sorry to tell John, but his analysis of what GE employees thought of Jack Welch during the successful years is 100% out of phase.
Are you one of those employees yourself?
Yes, I'm a 35-year employee with GE. I retired in middle management. People were so afraid of Jack Welch. He had lobbyists in Washington who whined and dined all the congressmen and even the president. He had people in state houses. And if you said a word against Jack Welch and it got back to a vice president, I don't care how good you would do in your performance, you would still get a very low performance rating and then sooner or later get fired.
Al, did you have Jack access Welch to stock options in your position?
Pardon?
Did you have access to stock options?
No, I did not. The vice president and general managers had access to stock options, and we know that they were stealing like bandits. But even the government was afraid of Jack Welch. As you see, the Hudson, the EPA did not start action to forcing GE to drain the Hudson River, dredge the Hudson River to get the PCBs out until after Jack Welch retired and Jeff Immelt came in.
Would it be fair to say, Al, that there was a class system where you had the group of managers access to stock options sort of being part of Jack Welch's club, and then the next layer of management down?
Oh, yes, there was. And the general managers got bonuses. They bought their wives brand new $50,000 and $60,000 Mercedes each year from forcing workers to make their productivity marks. So from general manager up, there was all of these perks, and they let Jack Welch get away with billions. And in fact, look at what Jack Welch is pulling on his wife. She will not get 50% of what he has earned.
I'm not sure how the whole divorce thing is going to work out, Al. One quick last one to you, and that is, the point that John was making, I think, was that at the time when General Electric was flying high, people were willing to zip their lips a little bit about the rate of compensation for someone like Jack Welch because everybody thought they were going to get a little piece of the pie.
No, sir. That's not true. The people that I know who made a complaint ended up getting paid from $500,000 to $1 million to sign a paper that they would not say anything and that they would resign from the company.
Al, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Nice to have you on the program. 1-800-423-8255 to Greensboro, North Carolina. Tony's on the line. Hi, Tony. Tony, are you there? I guess not. So we're going to try Durham, North Carolina, where Paul is standing by. Paul, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, thanks for calling.
Good morning. I want to express that there have, what the previous caller said, there have been many investors that have been frustrated for a number of years about what's been going on with we feel helpless, I think, about how to repair it. And understanding that there's, I think, tension between a democracy, which is a moral environment, and capitalism, which is amoral.
But the democracy of the marketplace, Paula, allows you to choose where you want to put your investment, right?
It does, but there's a limit to the amount investors can of information investors can accumulate about boards and managers and what's going on in a company. I mean, there's just no way that we can accumulate all the information we need to make an informed decision.
So, do you think that we need rules imposed?
Well, I think that I wanted to really query your guest.
Yeah, his name's John. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to ask, what do they think about the possibility of some sort of legislation that would do essentially what Ben and Jerry did when they founded their ice cream company, and that is to say, we want to designate that there's a maximum total compensation we can receive based on the relative pay of the lowest paid employee. I mean, is there any possibility that something like that could happen or work?
It's a very good question. I mean, I think the only conceivable way something like that could be introduced would be in response to a massive public campaign with people taking to the streets and storming Congress, really. I mean, the Congress, you know, is in hock to the senior executives because they're the source of the campaign contributions. And even in the, you know, recent weeks, recent months, after all the revelations of corporate theft and corporate wrongdoing, I don't see great mass protests up and down, you know, Pennsylvania Avenue saying, let's have some reforms. It's just one of the remarkable things about the, you know, American society in general, that people are willing to accept a large degree of inequality, most people are, and massive rewards at the top because they think either it's justified or that these guys deserve it or that maybe they can get some of the money at some point themselves. But, you know, I think in answer to your question, no, I don't see any chance of that sort of legislation being introduced without an enormous change in public opinion and public political activity.
Paula, thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Bye. John, the statements that have been made in the last little while from the Federal Reserve executives in New York.
Yeah.
Alan Greenspan this summer, I think, talked about an infectious greed.
Right.
And then we had William McDonough just last week, president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and I'll quote a line here. He said, CEOs and their boards should simply reach the conclusion that executive pay is excessive and adjust it to a more reasonable and justifiable levels. He went on to talk about it as terribly bad social policy and perhaps even bad morals. Does something like that stick, or do we end up just sort of beating ourselves on the back with a birch stick while things are bad, and then we forget all about it when the prices start going up again?
I think the latter, really. I mean, something like that would stick if it was embodied in some sort of legislation or some sort of change in corporate practices. But the fact is, you know, as you say, when those markets start going back up again and the greed juices start flowing again, the same structures basically are going to be in place, and we'll probably go through this all again, you know, when the in the next bull market. I think it is useful that people like Greenspan and Bill McDonough make speeches like this. I think moral suasion, you know, is important, but it has to be taken up on a much broader level by the whole political system, I think, and by chief executives themselves. You know, it would make more, I think it would have more impact if Jack Welch stood up and, you know, said that a chief executive pay has got out of hand, and I realised that I was mistaken or something. I think something like a gesture like that would have a lot more impact than Bill McDonough, the chairman of the New York Fed, saying it, or even Alan Greenspan, because people expect that, because these are regulators in the final analysis. You know, you need a change. You need either a change in legislation or a change in the corporate culture.
And that's sort of what I wanted to get at, the corporate culture, whether or not the example of Welch's letter in the Wall Street Journal saying, okay, I'm not going to take the package that was negotiated for me, is something that might be a harbinger of what other investors can look for in other corporate leaders.
Well, I think certainly at the moment there does seem to be signs of change. I mean, the New York Times had a piece yesterday about how, you know, compensation packages are changing slightly and severance packages are getting less generous. But I tend to think that that's a sort of artifact of the stock market bust and of the recession. And I don't see what's happened really to prevent, you know, excessive executive pay and excessive compensation coming back as soon as the stock market picks up. I mean, I think we need some more legislation and some more, as you say, moral suasion from business leaders. There are two or three who've spoken out publicly, the chairman of Bethlehem Steel and a couple of others. But most people have just kept quiet and trying to keep their head down because they don't want to be associated with, you know, with this great public relations fiasco. So I'm not very optimistic, to be honest.
John, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
John Cassidy is a writer for The New Yorker magazine, author of the article, which is in this week's edition, called The Greed Cycle. He's also author of the book, Dot Con, The Greatest Story Ever Told. Earlier in the program, we chatted with Lori Cohen, senior writer at The Wall Street Journal. Connection listeners, I invite you to our website. We're at www.theconnection.org, where our forum page will allow you to exchange views with other people. Our program's produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Orit Karitsky-Fox, Allison McAdam, Lindsay Miller, Tara Murphy, Christina Russo, and Doug Shugerts. Graham Smith's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be.
This is WBUR.